hard-hitting, intelligent discussion, painstakingly researched, thought-provoking opinions, and deep insight when you need it most. You'll get none of that here. Broadcasting from a secret location deep within America's heartland, Unapologetically Mediocre Studios presents the No Better Than Average podcast with your hosts, Jacob Cazell and Jeff Janey.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 40 of the No Better Than Average podcast. My name is Jeff Janey, and along with me today is my friend, my colleague, my... I don't even know what else to call you. Jacob, how you doing?
I'm good. Woo, episode 40. Woo, round 40. Numbers divisible by 10.
Woo.
That's a milestone of sorts.
Not at all, really, but that's okay.
It feels important.
It does. We need to maybe start thinking about what we're going to do for episode number 52, which actually is a milestone.
But it's not prime.
Okay, fine. So, hey, we have a special guest this week. Pretty excited.
Again?
I know. Again.
Two cats
in
a row.
And dogs living together. It's awesome.
Yeah, I'm seriously really excited. A cool guest.
Yeah, we have with us today Joshua Doan, who is an author and has now published two books that are part of what is going to be the Hyperion Empire series. And I think you've read the first one. I'm about halfway through the first one.
Yep.
Really enjoying it so far. Looking forward to finishing it up. And really interesting guest. So I hope everybody enjoys that.
Yeah.
Just a few housekeeping items. If you want to give us a call, please feel free to do so at the call-in comment line, which is 317-643-1212. Give us your least favorite song maybe on there. Give us some comments, any show topics you might want us to cover. If you know someone that you might think people would find interesting for us to talk to, we're always looking for leads in that area too, because we do enjoy talking to other people, and I'm sure you guys probably enjoy hearing someone else besides us occasionally, or maybe a lot. Obviously, everybody, you missed out on the t-shirts. Hopefully by this point, they are all shipped and the people that ordered them are getting hit on left and right because of their attractiveness and the downright sexiness that they are protruding with their No Better Than Average t-shirt. But
You'll have to be beating the people off with both hands.
That's right. But if you do want to support the show, we would ask that maybe you consider becoming a patron of our show by going over to Patreon, www.patreon, that's patreon.com/nobettershow. Feel free to donate a Maserati per show, or a dollar. It just goes a long way to helping us out. One of the discussions that we actually have today is talking about possibly looking into trademarking our brand, and that is not free. So,
no, it is not.
Any amount of help that you could give us so that we can make sure we keep our brand intact and maybe grow our show into something special, we would really appreciate it. It goes a long way towards helping us out. But as always, we'll keep bringing it to you no matter whether or not you give us anything for it or not. So, look at it this way.
We're the foolish ones here.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but seriously, we love doing the show.
We do. So. Absolutely.
Any help is appreciated, but not necessary.
Absolutely. We do have a couple more, just one more addition. I believe you're going to play a phone call.
Yes. John called in and gave us his least favorite song and had some other kind words for us. So I'm going to play that now for you all.
Hey guys, this is John Kramer calling from the little no man's land between Carmel and Indianapolis. Just thought I would call in and let you know the song that I detest, deplore, that drove me batty. That was a tough one because there's been a few, some that some people like, but. And it's not a slam on country, but that darn song, Achy Breaky Heart, has got to be on that list of songs. There are people, I'm sure, that enjoy it. I'm sure it was a nice, pleasant dance line song at the time. But when I was working as a summer intern at an aluminum smelter, it was on the radio in the office, and that radio station played it every hour on the hour, all day long, and boy, did it get old. That would be my nomination. I believe that was a Billy Ray Cyrus song. I tried to block that from my mind. Thank you. Have a great day.
So, yeah, I think we can probably all agree that adding Achy Breaky Heart to this list is,
yep,
is going to be right up there on the not favorites for more than one person.
There's going to be at least a couple of songs I feel like people are going to skip on this playlist because I feel like the New Kids on the Block song, Please Don't Go Girl, probably going to get skipped by a lot of people. Achy Breaky Heart, probably going to get skipped by a lot of people. Tiptoe Through the Tulips, probably going to get skipped by a lot of people.
And that's okay. That's okay. Gosh darn it.
Yeah. I got a quick little one. A buddy of mine named Tim has written an iOS game called I'll Pass, and it is a fun little game. So I want to give Tim a bump, a plug, as it were. He doesn't even know that I am doing this, so I will give him a surprise when I let him know.
And a bill for advertising, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Sorry. Just kidding.
That's how we do around here. Now pay up, Tim. You sure got a nice game. It would be a shame if something was to happen to it. It's a fun little game. It's available for iOS. Sorry, all you Android folks. If he makes money on it, he may consider porting it. But he is an Apple guy. Woo, Apple. But the premise is really simple. It's a card chip game. And honestly, if this was a real physical game that I could buy, I think it would be a blast to play at parties. It's four players. You can play solo and it'll do some computer generated players. It has a multiplayer mode, which you can pay a couple of bucks and unlock via an in-app purchase. And then you can play with real live players. But the way it works is there are cards, I believe, from like 3 to 30 something. And they're randomly dealt out. And the way it works is all four players, you get like 11 chips to start. And if you don't want that card, and the whole point of the game is to have the lowest hand, you have to pay a chip. And it just keeps going around and around in a circle until somebody decides either to take the card and they get all of those chips, or they run out of chips and have to take the card. And so the goal is to end up with the lowest score. And I realize it sounds more complicated than it is, but darn it, is it a fun little game. It sucked me in. I have been playing it off and on since he published it, and it just came out. By the time you are hearing this, it'll have been out for a few weeks, but go give it a look. It's a fun game. You're helping out an independent game developer and a good guy, Tim. Check it out on the iTunes store called All Pass. It's a lot of fun. So yeah, go give it a look. It's free at the worst case, so even if you hate it, download it and delete it, but I think you will enjoy it. So you're supporting a good guy, an independent app developer. It's free, so you know you can download it, and even if you hate it, you can delete it. You're not out anything but a couple of minutes of your time. I think you'll enjoy it. It's a lot of fun. Check it out.
So let's get to the interview with Joshua Doan and hear what he has to say. Some interesting stuff coming up here.
Are you there, Joshua?
Yes, I am.
All right. I couldn't hear if it connected or not, so I want to make sure we weren't talking about something completely unrelated, and you're just sitting there going, what are these guys doing?
Yeah, I can totally understand that.
Awesome. I'm Jacob, and this is Jeff.
Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Jeff.
That's me.
Hello, Jacob. Yeah, I'm seeing your microphone set up. It really makes me feel like I should set up mine. That's still in a box somewhere after the move.
I hate moving.
Yeah, it was not a pleasant experience because it was during the big heat wave we had in Washington.
Ooh.
Never gets above 100 here, but it was above 100 every single day. And we were moving a big house with lots of stuff. So fortunately, my brother's a really good baseball player.
Yeah.
And he convinced a good quarter of his team to come out and help us haul boxes.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Very nice indeed.
So, you know, really what we want to do is not so much sit and like grill you, but really just kind of have a conversation, talk about, you know, what it's like to be an author, talk about the books and the story. And, you know, our whole goal for the podcast is really just to have, you know, conversations with people who do interesting things or who are interesting people. And, you know, I can't even imagine what it would take to conceptualize a story and write it and have it be novel length. So to me, that's, you know, pretty amazing in the first place. So that's kind of what we do. It's just to have an interesting conversation with an interesting person and kind of see where it goes. So I don't really have a set agenda. I've written down some questions, but that's really more so that I'm not stumbling along going, so you like books, right?
That's a great premise for a podcast. I'm all on board with that.
Yeah, and so we can kind of just let it go anywhere. Jeff and I tend to... okay, let's see. He's trying to get back in touch with me. Okay, let me see if I can add him. Always have those technical difficulties, you know.
Of course. It's the technology age. Instead of, car troubles, we have Skype troubles.
Yeah. I'm sorry, you were saying something about the premise for your next book?
It wasn't really a premise. It's just some subtext that I have in my novels. I deal a lot with people who are cybernetically enhanced.
Yeah,
and
right.
So we were talking about technical troubles, and I said, well, what happens when, you know, it's not just Skype troubles, but people are actually trying to hack the hardware you got in your head, you know, that type of stuff.
Yeah, you know, the possibility and the potential is amazing, but a little terrifying at the same time. But I will admit, I will be one of the first ones in line when they can put a memory chip right inside of my brain. I would love that.
Well, and then you get practical telepathy, because if you can talk to somebody else's computer chip in their head, you won't need to actually use your voice. You can have this like cybernetic chat.
You know, just what I need is another excuse to be antisocial and never interact with people physically again. I was just kind of explaining, Jeff, to Joshua, kind of our... what the podcast is, and that we really just try and have kind of a conversation and let it go wherever it goes. And, you know, sometimes we get way down rabbit holes and, you know, it's,
and that's okay.
Yeah. And that's fine with us. So, I was actually listening, gosh, and I'm going to forget the name of the podcast, that I had found you on, like Geek Smash maybe, or Geek something, talking about the Hyperion Engine series. And you guys were off and down some deep holes and talking about the Kardashev scale and all kinds of stuff like that. So, you know, all that's great. We love all that, you know, nerdy, techie, sciencey stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I really try to have a good mix of practicality and high tech. And what I do is almost everything that I put in my novels is based off of some real scientific theory, so that it doesn't feel too out of place. It's like, you won't find transporter beams and teleporters or, you know, force magic stuff in my novels, because I try to base everything off of practicality.
Whoa. You're telling me the force isn't real? You stop it.
Well, we know it's
don't
genetic.
Ruin it for me.
You have to force it into your story.
But the midichlorians, they're all in me.
I know, because they have the word medi in their name. They're obviously true, right?
It sounds official.
It's obviously medical, because they're the medichlorians. When I first heard that, believe it or not, I thought they were talking about nanites.
Okay, sure, I can see that.
Actually, that,
you know, mini medibots. You know, I thought they were talking about medibots. So really, the force is something where the technology's advanced to the point where it's become microscopic and it's holding everything together, because there was like some universe breaking event, and so they had to fix it with these. And then, no, they wouldn't have ruined it by making it.
Yeah, it wasn't that. It was just George Lucas pooping on our collective childhoods.
Yes, I did. I did feel the nice warm ooze on that one.
Yeah. I just recently listened to Adam Savage, who acknowledges that episode 1, 2, and 3 exist, but refuses to believe that they are part of canon, and is hoping that episode 7 resurrects everything. So.
Well, I'm a big fan of the extended universe in Star Wars. And so I was very upset when I heard that Disney had announced that the extended universe was no longer canon.
Really? I had not heard that. I haven't followed it super deep, but I'm kind of surprised about that, because there is so much of it. And I think Timothy Zahn is doing the new movie screenplay, and he's written a huge amount of the extended universe, hasn't he?
Yes, I believe so. I'm not 100% on that. But I think what they said is that it will influence the new Star Trek universe, Star Wars universe, but it will not dictate the new Star Wars universe.
So did you read any of the Timothy Zahn ones?
I read a whole bunch. I don't remember who wrote them, because I read them when I was a kid. This was before I started reading people like Brandon Sanderson and Jim Butcher and stuff like that.
So the Timothy Zahn series is with Mara Jade and the Emperor's Clone.
Yes,
and,
yes, yeah, yeah. I read okay. Those.
Have you read any of Timothy Zahn's other books?
I don't know. I mean, when I was a kid, I wasn't I mean, this is terrible to say as an author, but when I was a kid, I never really paid too much attention to the authors. I paid attention to which storylines they were.
Because what's interesting, so Timothy Zahn, my first experience with him, there's a series of books called The Cobra Initiative. Mm-hmm. And it kind of, I mean, it's not exactly like yours, but it kind of reminds me of it. The idea is that they've cybernetically and genetically enhanced soldiers to fight in the wars. Mm-hmm. And now the wars are over. And how do those soldiers reintegrate back into society?
The remnant effect.
Huh.
Yeah. And those are really good books too. If you just want some reading, they're pretty good.
Yeah. Well, a question you guys asked me earlier was how I got into writing, how I decided to create a universe, and then how I went into creating the universe. Would you like me to break that apart?
Yeah, absolutely.
Please.
Yeah, we kind of already started. I'm recording.
Yeah, we're recording. So
it's like I said, it's very informal. Just a casual conversation.
So the way it happened was I was a little frustrated with modern science fiction, because a lot of the big, science fiction shows had ended. There wasn't any more Firefly. There wasn't any more Star Trek. It really felt like things had lagged behind and science fiction adventure was out. It was no longer hip. And so I was talking with my brother, complaining over actually Skype, about what I thought a good science fiction universe would be, because a lot of these, even the big ones like Star Trek and Star Wars and stuff like that, had these huge plot holes you could drive semis through. And so we were discussing, what would you do to create a science fiction universe? And I started going through, Alcubierre engines, which is what I, based the gravity stream drive off of, the colony ships, the fleet organization, the way people react when presented with a threat is really important. And it's what I think that a lot of the science fiction gets wrong. You get a lot of these shows where they hem and haw about intervening and threatening people on a planet to get their people back, as if a diplomatic incident was on an equal footing with people's lives. Stuff like that. Problems that are contrived, like the Jedi's not being able to marry. Things that cause war and destruction and chaos needlessly, whereas if they had struck first and struck hard, it would not have been as much of a problem, because real military commanders behave in a certain way. And so I started describing how people would behave in these various situations, and I started describing how those situations would come to be, and then eventually I got to the starting point, which was the prologue of The Exile Empire, which was first contact with an alien species.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of times in science fictions, people just assume that mankind's going to unify. Whereas if we've reached space age, we're obviously unified in a single cohesive mass. And I know a lot of the science fiction book authors get this right, but a lot of the movie guys didn't. That's what was bugging me at the time. So what I did was I described how these different factions would be forced to come together if they met a cohesive alien force that was harvesting, destroying, and consuming everything that mankind produced. And that's where the story began. I began writing the fall of the human civilization and the exile and what happens when you get there. Because one story that they don't cover a lot in fiction is something that's actually very fundamental to the human experience. And that is diaspora, where one people group moves into an area and conquers it, which disperses the previous people. And those previous people are not just push to go wander out and disperse, but a lot of times they move in a bunch and then they disperse somebody else, which disperses somebody else, mm-hmm. which causes new political events in this area, new alliances and new empires. In fact, that's the whole concept of the Aeneid in classical literature. The Trojans had been defeated and they were wandering around the Mediterranean for years trying to figure out, okay, what are we going to do with this really broken civilization we had? Oh, I know. Let's conquer this area over here and ally with these other guys and build a new civilization. So I took a lot of inspiration from history, from tactics, from real military commanders. And I said, okay, how would this pan out? And everybody always assumes that we are on a course where we always go from dictatorship towards democracy. And I wanted to also show that that's not always the case. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, you know, it's interesting you say that because one of the things that that struck me is, and I haven't had a chance to get both books read because I've got a 5-year-old and a crazy life, but I got The Exile Empire read. And one of the things that really struck me was the description of the battles from the humans against the Tarant Hall. It seemed very, you know, 17th and 18th century naval. Yeah. You know, it reminded me of I've read some of the, and I know they're huge favorites of Jeff's, the Aubrey Maturin series, the Master and Commander mm-hmm. books. And I've read a few of those. And some of the battles in space kind of struck me as reminiscent of some of those naval battles of, you know, hundreds of years ago. So yeah, I definitely got that sense from reading, at least the first book.
Yeah. I mean, I really do think that space battle is just naval battle, but in three dimensions instead of two, because you have to have people encapsulated to protect them from the elements, and you're going to have vast distances involved mm-hmm. where positioning yourself before you engage the enemy is where all the victory comes from. Because it's not like in Star Wars and Star Trek where you got two guys flying at each other and ships are going every which way and it immediately goes into dogfights. That's not what happens when you have multiple groups of high-powered warships with no territory around them. You can't have guerrilla tactics. You can't Right. have dogfights when you have these huge ships involved. Yeah, the fighters are going to devolve into dogfights, but until you actually mix your ships with the enemy, there's tactics before then. And everybody always ignores those long distance tactics before you actually get close enough to have your ships tangled up.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, one of the things I thought was interesting too, and, you know, I will admit I have not read every single science fiction based in space book out there, but I don't know that I have, I recall having read this before, and it, you know, it actually makes a lot of sense, but one of the tactics that the human fleet employs is spinning their battleships to fire in all directions. And I thought, well, of course you would do that in space. Why wouldn't you? Because you do have, you're not working in a 2D environment. You've got, you know, enemies that could come at you from every direction. And I thought that was actually kind of brilliant. And I don't know that I've ever read that before.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where I look at science fiction and I'm like, that ship has vulnerable spots, has blind spots where their guns can't reach. And even if you have, let's say, big guns on the top and little strafing guns on the side, what happens if the strafing ships go at your top and the big ships go along your side? You got to get that ship into a spin, especially if you're outnumbered, mm-hmm. because you got to be able to defend yourself and keep those ships from flanking you. Because it doesn't matter if you're talking about, you know, Roman ships going up against, you know, the Greek ships or, you know, modern cruisers versus aircraft carriers. If you're flanked, you're doomed.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Awesome maneuver.
So you said that you like to write about technology that's at the very least inspired by, you know, physics and not just, you know, complete fantasy. So, you know, how do you go about, you know, taking a physical concept or at least an idea that could work within the realm of physics and developing it out to, okay, we have it and it's not, you know, magic per se, but obviously it is compared to the level of technology we have today, and still create ideas that are credible, because you know, I think that's hard to get right.
Well, that's more art than science, and I know that's hard to say when we're talking literally about science, but it's where the two worlds meet most strongly. You have to really get a feel for it, and then you have to build it backwards. Once you come up with the idea, you really need a couple of people that are sounding walls. And then without telling them how you develop that idea, spit the idea out and mm-hmm. say, can you think of how this might come to be? And if they can't come up with any way that developed out of modern technology or modern theories, then you might need to reconsider how you went about employing that technology in the story.
Yeah, that would, I think, definitely be a hard thing to come up with, you know, that 400 year leap of, you know, how do we get from where we are today to, you know, everybody has, you know, cybernetic implants and can communicate and basically, like you were saying, has telepathy, which I never really thought about that before, but that's, you know, a pretty interesting way to look at it. And yeah. I can't wait. I hope I live long enough.
Okay. I feel bad because I haven't got through the first book. So I just started reading them on Monday.
Well, so, The Exile Empire is more tactical, more civilization level of the story. And Empire Ascensions is more of the maturity of that and where it comes of age. And you also get the main character coming of age as well.
Because I found it interesting, and I don't know if this was intentional or obviously I haven't finished the first book, so I don't know like where it's going. But where I'm at in the current book, they're just starting their alliance. I found it interesting that they allied basically with the first set of aliens that they came across that looked anything like them at all.
Yeah.
And that was their first ally. And I found that kind of interesting. I assume that you kind of did that on purpose. And, you know, don't spoil it for me if there's a twist to this, because I haven't read that yet. But
the conclusion of that twist isn't concluded until three more trilogies down the road.
Oh, okay. Because I just found it interesting that it seemed like that the humans were extremely trusting very quickly because they looked like us. And I thought that that was very interesting because I think that that's probably fairly realistic. As humans, we like what we know, right? I mean, that's a human nature, human trait. And
oh, absolutely.
It's very much intentional. I mean, if you saw a giant insectoid creature with blades the size of your face on it that can, you know, eat you in one bite, you're not going to want to make friends with that. Your instinct is to kill or run away. Your fight or flight response will kick in.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, and that's one thing. Maybe there is, so maybe I should preface this question or change how I'm going to ask this. I felt like the book immediately jumped into, and I don't want to give too much away, so stop me if I get too into, you know, spoilers, but we jump into this race called the Harvesters has, you know, really just wiped out huge numbers of the human population. And then we're confronted with the group or the race that they call that just death. And I feel like there's a whole story to be told about that we don't get. It's almost like we're jumping into book two. I wanted to know a lot more about what led up to that point. It's the beginning.
Well, it's got to have prequels of this book. Eventually.
Yeah. I mean, I intended that for prequels. The story, I actually started the story at 2000 BC. That was 4000 BC. And it goes up to 4000 AD.
Okay.
So I have the entire story arc starting in the past and going all the way to 2000 years in the future.
So I assume based on what you're saying with all the books that you're talking about, this is what you want to make your career, correct?
It is going to be a big part of my literary career. I have, I think it's six trilogies mapped out to tell the whole story.
Wow.
And that, if I was writing full time, that would only take me a couple of years. I can write a book in about 3 months if I was writing full time. I'm not. I have a day job because writing doesn't, you know, pay the bills yet.
Yeah.
Right.
But I am working on my first fantasy novel at the moment. I have about a dozen other book concepts just waiting in the wings to write once I have time and energy to get to those.
Wow.
So I don't plan for it to be my entire writing career, but I do plan for it to be my magnum opus.
So that was actually one of my questions, was to find out if you were a full-time author or not. And, you know, so that is a huge, to me, it sounds like, anyway, not being a writer, that sounds like a huge amount of at least outline mapped out like that. I haven't planned for what Jeff and I are going to talk about like 2 weeks down the road on the podcast, let alone six trilogies plus fantasy plus all of these other things. So, you know, how do you, I guess, find the time to write and work and have a life? I know you said that you just moved and, you know, just the, day-to-day life is hard, especially when you're, you know, working a regular job to find a time to do your passion and your hobby. You know, how do you fit all that in?
You don't. you have to sacrifice somewhere, be it sleep, social life. You know, lately I haven't had a chance to write in the past several months because I've been looking for a new day job. And that's been, you know, the full-time problem because trying to get, you know, my girlfriend a fiance visa, and you need a full-time job to get that. So that's been my focus for the past few months.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like that journey is almost over. So that's real nice. There's not enough hours in the day.
I can't even imagine it. Not with that kind of outline that you have mapped.
No. And the way I did it was I actually sat down. My dad ran a small company for a while and had these gigantic, surplus whiteboards that were the size of an entire wall. And so I just graphed the entire timeline of the entire story on rings on this, like a musical sheet, and, you know, drew out the major dates, the major battles, the influences, the characters, their descendants, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then I took a picture of that whole thing. And so that's now the secret picture hidden in deep in my files that no one's allowed to see.
It very
just make sure you back that up two or three places.
Yes, I have it backed up in multiple places. And I even mailed myself a copy of it on a CD to do the poor man's copy on the copyright on the entire story arc.
Yeah, so you never open it and then you have proof of at least the concept date.
Yes, I do.
I have heard of that before. I've never actually met anybody that's done it, but I've always heard that you can do it. That's pretty cool.
Well, everything I do, I don't just trust one way of doing it. And this is for when I write, when I keep copies of things, when I create concepts, when I work with artists on my comics, everything. I always keep backed up in multiple places. So what I do is regular copyright and poor man's copyright, regular copyright and poor man's copyright.
Wow. So you actually take the time to submit to the copyright and trademark office and get a copyright, huh?
I don't do things half, but no.
Wow. We probably should do something like that with our show, but we take the lazy way.
Well, it's commentary. It's hard to copyright commentary.
It's true. I mean, we could legally.
Yes, I would trademark your brand. That's not that hard to do.
Yeah, we're waiting to get some of that internet money from our listeners before we do that, because I have gone through the trademark process before in another life when I was a small business owner, and it gets expensive and time consuming.
Yes,
it's not fun.
Have a lawyer.
Even if you have a lawyer, it's time consuming. It's expensive. There's fees that you've got to pay, and mm-hmm. it's not fun. And you have to do it at the state level, and then you have to do it at the federal level. I don't recommend it if you don't have to deal with that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Those six trilogies I discussed aren't actually the full extent of the story. I'm currently developing three graphic novels. One is an online graphic novel, like a web comic, so you can go and read the beginning of it already.
Oh, cool.
I'm also developing an app, and I have the concept in the work for a giant MMO. So hopefully that will pan out.
Wow. That's ambitious.
You can't say I'm anything but ambitious. I forgot to mention this. I'm also pitching an anime.
Well, that's cool. So,
So how old are you? I mean, not to be rude, but how old are you?
You've got more energy than us.
Yeah.
Only on a good day. Only on a good day. I'm 30. I just turned 30 a couple months ago.
Okay. Well, wait till you catch up to the 40s.
I, what are you talking about? I plan to always stay young.
Yeah, well, I think one of the keys here is he has a better work ethic than either of us, Jacob.
I was going to say, I don't think our problem is that we're, you know, 40, pushing 40 and approaching 40. It's that we're both lazy, and Joshua here sounds like a hard worker.
No, the thing is, I just won't accept it not succeeding, and so I keep pushing no matter what.
And that's what you've got to do. Mm-hmm. So you have six trilogies mapped out. You've got an MMO. You've got a graphic novel.
Three graphic novels.
Three graphic novels.
It's more scripts on the way.
So I mean, that is incredibly ambitious, even for, you know, someone who's a full-time writer. So of all of that, is there some amount of that that you say, if I get this piece done, but I don't accomplish the other things, then I'm satisfied? Or is it all or nothing? Because that's just, to me, sounds like an overwhelming challenge to make come to fruition. You know, man, I'm impressed.
As an author, if you ever reach the point where you say, I'm satisfied, you will probably never finish another book.
That's a good way to look at it. But at what point would you be able to say, and this is all within and you're calling this world the Hyperion Engine world. Is that correct from what I've read? No,
the Hyperion Empire.
The Hyperion Empire. I'm sorry. I knew it was Hyperion something. And
the books are The Exile Empire. That came out last year, and Empire Ascension.
Right. Okay.
And that came out this year.
But I guess my question is, like, could you consider the Hyperion Empire successful if it doesn't hit all of those points? Because you also said that you've got fantasy and some other things already lined out. And, you know, would you ever feel comfortable closing the chapter on that to move on and work on other things? Or do you think, like Jeff was saying, that this will be, you know, the thing that you focus on until you're 60? Because it sounds like you've got enough to keep you busy until you're 60.
Yeah, I have enough writing material to write for the rest of my life without ever coming up with something new.
Wow.
But that doesn't mean that I'm going to let that happen. Because once I'm a full-time writer, you know, if that ever happens, then I'm going to have more time, which means I can write more books more quickly. And that means I can complete projects at a greater rate and have more resources to do parallel projects like the games and the comics.
Sure.
So I will consider the Exile Empire novel series a success when I can either start writing full time or have the resources to really ratchet the other projects up to another degree of activity.
Sure, sure. You know, to what level do you feel you have to get to be able to say, you know, I'm doing this full time?
What can I say? Student loan payments and housing payments.
I understand those. They never go away, do they?
No, especially not when, you know, you're 30 and you haven't had a chance to have really great jobs.
Yeah. So I know that you are on Amazon, and I want to say, did I remember that this is published through the Zarme Publishing Press?
Correct.
So how does that work for the smaller, you know, independent author? I mean, is that considered, you know, self-published, or is Zarme doing, you know, the work that a larger publishing house would do? Or, you know, how does that work from an author's standpoint? Because it seems like there's never been a better time for an independent author to get their work and to get their ideas out there than there is now.
Yeah. I mean, don't self-publish. Never self-publish. Never self-publish.
Really?
I cannot recommend that strongly enough. Never touch self-publishing, even with a 29.5-foot pole. It is the death kiss of death for any novel. Zarmai is a small publisher in the traditional sense. They do the editing, and I have dyslexia. I have severe dyslexia, so I take no pride in my spelling or flopping around of letters or anything like that. And I know, a dyslexic author, it's kind of silly. but they do the editing, they do the artwork, they do the formatting, they put it out to all the distributors like Amazon, Barnes & Noble, the smaller guys. They get it in the stores, they make the deals. The only area where I found them to be lacking is marketing.
Sure.
But that's because they're a small company and they don't have, you know, $10 million to put behind their next blockbuster that's coming out.
Right.
You know, so it's, I can't really rag on them for that, but as, you know, as an author with big aspirations, I'd love to have more marketing.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's, you can never have too much marketing, right? Especially. Yeah, today, when you've got so much to compete against.
Yeah, I was going to make a joke about Twilight having too much marketing because that's a matter of opinion. You can look at a certain thing and say that's not deserving of marketing, and then anything that it gets is too much marketing.
Yeah, and I think it proves that you know, there's definitely room for even the fast food of writing, because Stephanie Meyer, that's Stephanie Meyer's, right?
Yeah, similar, I think.
They've got a lot more money than I do. Let's just put it that way.
That's not really fast food. I'd say that's the red light district of writing.
My daughter loves those books. bless her little heart.
You may need to watch her a little closely in her choice of boyfriends then.
Well, I've read them. I mean, I get it. Yeah. No.
At least she's not reading 50 Shades. Well, I don't know she's not, but I hope she's not.
She's not. Let's just go with she's not. She's only 13. We're going to go with she's not.
Okay.
And that was Twilight fan fiction, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's amazing to me that exists. But, you know, hey, I guess to each their own. Wow.
My writing circle calls it 50 Shades of Nope.
Yeah.
The favorite thing, and I don't really know anything. I mean, I know what 50 Shades is, but I've not read it. I haven't gone and seen the movie. I have no interest. But the best thing I ever saw, or I suppose technically heard, is Gilbert Gottfried read 50 Shades of Grey and made it available out on the internet. So you can actually download Gilbert Gottfried reading 50 Shades of Grey. It is amazing.
That sounds hilarious.
Yeah, and it's just an audiobook that you can go and listen to if you want to for some reason.
You know, whatever floats your boat. I mean,
so you've got, you know, these huge grandiose plans. I mean, obviously there is a history, especially in the world of fantasy and sci-fi, for, you know, these huge arcing, you know, storylines, some of them that go on for, you know, dozens of books and more. So, you know, before you decided to become an author, or maybe even after you decided to become an author, you know, who were some of the writers that really inspired you? You know, was there any seminal author or work that, you know, that made you say, yes, this is what I want to do? Like what brought you to this?
I think it was a slowly developing thing. Of course, my introduction to reading was Tolkien. My dad, when I was a little kid, read me the first Lord of the Rings book, and I loved it. And I wanted more, but he didn't have time to read me the other one. And so even though my reading level was far below Tolkien at that time, I picked it up and started pecking my way through the book. And, you know, as a little kid, sounding out the words and things like that. And eventually I made it through The Lord of the Rings and started reading more. I read C.S. Lewis. I started reading, you know, other fantasy, like Jim Butcher. Started reading S.M. Sterling. Started reading, you know, a lot of the big sci-fi guys.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think I wanted to be an author as a kid before I went to college. However, when I went through all my old school records, I found several half-finished stories that were kind of the first, you know, half-effort attempt at a novelette or something like that. Like, I kind of do remember attempting to write these and not telling anybody about it and then stuffing it in a drawer because I was embarrassed about it. And so apparently I wanted to write novels ever since I was a little kid. I just never admitted it to myself until I made it to college.
Well, very cool. I mean, is there a favorite book or series out there that, I mean, you're like, this is my go-to when you've got nothing else to read?
Jim Butcher.
Okay. I'm not familiar with him.
So yeah, I was just looking at your Goodreads account and I noticed a lot of Jim Butcher stuff. I have not read any of his stuff. So once I'm done with yours, I have another new reading thing.
So yes. What has he written? Would there be something of his that I would know, maybe not by his name?
Yeah, probably that would be The Dresden Files.
Okay.
That's his most famous work. That's the one that he has the most novels out in by far. He also wrote a series called The Codex Alera, which is a Swords and Horses series.
Okay.
Which was phenomenal until the last book.
I kind of feel that way about The Wheel of Time.
Really? I actually think the last three books of The Wheel of Time were great, but the first ones weren't.
The story got so big and encompassing, it got to the point where it was hard at the end to keep everything straight. Sure. I actually don't know if I've read the last book, and that one was not written by Jordan, right?
Yeah. The last three were written by Brandon Sanderson.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think I've read any of those three.
Yeah, those three are by far the best. However, the last book was so truncated at the end that it felt like a man with his head cut off.
Really?
It was great. The battle was phenomenal. Wrapped up the final battle perfectly, but you need some more conclusion. I mean, every writer knows that you have the story arc where you have, you know, conflict, build up, climax, resolution, follow up, build up, climax, resolution, follow up.
Isn't it basic, because it's the Wheel of Time? Don't you just go back to the first book to get the? Yeah.
that's the thought anyway, but it's not how he ends it.
Oh, okay.
But I mean, the final battle was phenomenal. I can't complain about anything leading up to the end. It's just he stopped it too early.
I need to go read the Sanderson ones, because like I think when Jacob said the last couple books, I think it was the last couple Robert Jordan books, and it was just like, you know, you're like reading and you're just like, you're introducing new plot lines and you're 9 books in, dude. Exactly. Stop.
Let's tie some of these up before we bring some new characters in.
Yeah.
And all the characters are almost named exactly the same.
That got hard to follow.
Yeah. It's like, I don't want to take notes. That's
if I'm reading a series, I shouldn't have to take notes, which is why I like long arc stories, but I also like it to be generational. That way, right, each arc is self-contained.
Absolutely.
If you do know everything that came previously, it'll be richer, but you aren't required to know everything that came previously in order to enjoy the books. In fact, I wrote, even though the first trilogy of The Exile Empire, they are an opening trilogy. They're meant to be read as a trilogy. I also wrote them to be able to be digested individually.
So when's the third coming? Because there's just two, right?
Yeah, the third's coming. I'm in the process of writing that one. However, the start of another trilogy in the same universe will come out before the third one in this trilogy.
Okay.
And it's in the same universe. So it's people in the Empire going and doing a mission for the Emperor. So.
Okay.
You mentioned something about if you were writing full time, you could produce pretty quickly. And I have to say, based on the published dates, and I don't know how much lead time there is from the time you finish writing to the time it's turned over to the publisher and it actually becomes a product. But Exile Empire was published in February of 2014, and then Empire Ascensions, the second book, was published May of 2015. That seems like a pretty quick turnaround to me. I mean, that's just a year, basically. Yeah. I mean, is that pretty typical or what is normal, I suppose?
Well, there's going to be a bigger gap this time because I took the break to look for a new job. Not this time, but I have another book that's going to be out before the end of the year. That's Blood Nobles, and I think that it's my best work yet, by far. I mean, every author is their worst critic, and I think the first two books are insignificant compared to the first book of Blood Nobles. If I'm writing normally, I can produce a book a year.
That to me seems like a lot if it's not something that you're doing full time. So like how fast, and I realize that it completely depends on the story and how fast it comes to you, but how fast do you write? Because if I were to sit down, I feel like it would take a lot more than a year to write 250, 300 pages. But when you're sitting there focused in the zone, like how many pages or chapters a day or a period, like what do you consider a rate that you're happy with if you finish? Because I have a friend who's an author who is, he's got some short stories out, he hasn't published his first novel yet, and he's like, man, if I get 800 good words from one writing session, I'm really happy. And to me that doesn't sound like a lot, but I'm also not an author, and that might be a huge amount if it's 800 words that you're happy with that have been written and first drafted and finalized and ready to go.
I would say that 2,000 on a bad day,
okay,
3,000 on a normal day, and 5,000 on a good day is about my rate.
And over what period of time? Like, is that like 8 hours, or is that like, less time than that?
It depends. I mean, I can sit down and write 3,000 words in 1 hour.
Really?
And if I have it ready in my head.
Sure.
Because you need to chew on it in your head before you can write it. It's like a cow chewing its cud. You gotta, you know, digest it, then you gotta chew on it some more.
Right.
And you gotta digest it again. But if I'm having a bad day, it could be 2,000 words over an 8-hour period. If I'm having a great day, it could be 5,000 words over 3 hours.
Wow. So do you like just stream of conscious it, or are you kind of editing as you go and trying to come up with at least semi-edited or finished work? Or is it just, you know, that kind of verbal diarrhea, get it all down and go back and tighten it up and clean it up later?
I write pretty clean.
Really?
Especially for somebody who has dyslexia. What I do is, it's called the fractal effect writing method. I think of a single thing that's going on in this situation. Then I consciously think of everything that would be required for that to happen. And then I think of all the characters, and I think from their perspective simultaneously. So you have to split your mind into thinking from every single character and every single moving object's perspective at the same exact time, and allow that to come to fruition, to spread out and create the scene in front of you. And then you pick your character and sit on their shoulder and you type what you see happening.
That to me sounds like way more balls in the air than I could manage at one time.
It takes a lot. And I think that my education in political economics is really what allows me to do it.
And I'm assuming that that's probably a discipline that you write a lot in the first place.
Yes, there's a lot of analysis. I actually did my senior thesis on currency unions and predicted the Portugal, Italy, Greece, Spain situation a year before it happened. So there's a lot of analysis going into it, a lot of writing, a lot of, you know, making sure that what you put down is accurate to what you see unfolding.
Is sci-fi your favorite? Or I know that Jim Butcher, you know, you said wrote sword and horse type stuff. So, I mean, do you like sci-fi better than fantasy, or?
Depends on my mood.
Yeah.
I mean, really, I'm the type of guy where I love story.
Mm-hmm.
And what really gets me is when you have the right story in the right setting with the right characters. And that can be a sci-fi, that can be contemporary fiction, and that can be fantasy. It really depends on the writer and what they're writing.
Okay. Other questions that interest me, because I like to understand the economics of it a little bit. So I know that your books are available paperback. I noticed that the first one is even Audible or audio, and then you have Kindle versions. So for you as an author, like, what's the best way? Like, what do you make the most money on? Like, if I go out and I'm okay, so, you know, I enjoy these books and I want to buy them. What's the best way that you get the most money? What's the most profitable for you?
Well, that's a double-edged sword, because when it comes to initial pocket change, the ebooks are the best for me, because it's basically all profit. There's no, you don't have to build the book. You don't have to ship the book. You don't have to, you know, process the book. It's just click and download.
Right.
But I really like it when people buy the physical books, because then there's something out there in the marketplace that their friends and family can see, that they can share, they can show that this is a thing that exists. And when it comes to smaller authors like me, that's the biggest hurdle to overcome, is letting people know that this is a thing. This thing is here. Take a look at it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it makes it tangible and real. Not that mm-hmm. an ebook is intangible, but yeah, I totally get that.
And it's easier for people to share it. And the best way for anything to spread is word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And it's harder to share and tell somebody about, oh, this great Kindle book I'm reading. Yeah, it happens, but not nearly as much as, oh, what are you reading? That is that, you know, and they see the novel, they see the cover, you know, that type of thing. So it's a give or take on what's going to be best for the book in the long term. And I think that's the physical book.
Yeah, ebooks are just so darn convenient. But I'm torn, because I love physical books, but I like my Kindle and I like to lay in bed and not have to worry about flipping pages. And I just click a button and I'm on the next page. I'm really conflicted on the ebook versus paper topic.
I think that Amazon has a deal where if you buy the physical book, the ebook is either cheaper or free. I think I remember seeing that somewhere. I'm not certain about that, so don't quote me on it. But I like programs like that because then people can have both.
Huh, you are right, because I'm looking on the Amazon page for The Exile Empire, and you are correct. It does have a thing called Matchbook, which I don't know that I've ever paid attention to before. And it says, for thousands of qualifying books, your past, present, and future print edition purchases now let you buy Kindle editions for $2.99 or less. So that's kind of cool. I'm going to have to check that out. And in this case, it does provide the Kindle edition for free if you've bought the paperback for The Exile Empire. So that's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, I like programs like that because it allows people to have their cake and eat it too.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, knowing that there is a physical binding of paper out there would definitely make me feel better if I was an author.
Yeah. If civilization falls apart in flames, there's a greater chance that one of my works will survive.
Yeah, you know, I have the same thing that I'm conflicted on with photography. Not that I do it as much anymore. I used to be a huge shutter bug. And, you know, digital, obviously, there's so many advantages to it. But there's just something so real and persistent and eternal about negatives. And, you know, you can't have it both ways. And that makes me a little sad. And I never really thought about it. But publishing in today's age has got to be exactly the same way.
Yeah. I mean, our biggest fear as an author is that the libraries will disappear.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
And with them, the bookstores. Oh, go ahead.
So as an author, Amazon, are you a fan or are you not a fan? Well, you live in Washington, so that I don't know if that makes a difference or not.
It might color it a little.
But yeah. Are you a fan, not a fan?
Amazon and independent authors are frenemies. Yeah. There are ways in which they help us a lot. And the ways in which they make us angry, angry, angry. What really bugs me is there's no filter. Anyone and everyone can go and self-publish their unedited, poorly written, poorly constructed book with no thought as to does this, you know, make a coherent story. Mm-hmm. And it's out there and it drowns out all the new good authors that are coming out. And I know at least a dozen, you know, really good self-published authors, but they get zero exposure because of how many absolutely horrible self-published authors there are out there.
Yeah, I mean, yes, but isn't that a case of, you know, in a meritocracy, the good will rise to the top? At least you hope that happens.
I don't believe in meritocracies because I don't think that the good, if it's drowned out and not enough, you know, one or the people, let's say five people see it and all five people like it. Well, there's going to be books where 20 people saw another one and 19 of them liked it. That's still way more likes than the guy with five.
That's true.
So it all depends on the amount of exposure you can give it initially. So if you have no funds to give it exposure initially, that meritocracy doesn't matter. So it's really a fiction. The idea that the good will automatically rise to the top simply because people like it. What if somebody gives one of the first, you know, 50 people to read a book, hate it, or they don't like that genre and they rate it down because of that, or they don't like the specific, you know, style of writing. The problem is that you can't just assume when there is a really good work that it's naturally going to rise, because I haven't seen that happen to other people.
Yeah. I guess are the Anthony Weirs and the Ernest Klein's out there, the oddballs, outliers who are, you know, just discovered out of nowhere? I mean, is that then the exception? Because I want to have faith that, you know, good stuff will get found and make its way into the collective consciousness. But maybe I'm just being too optimistic.
I think that they had big marketing budgets on their own. and they were able to promote it enough to be able to get it seen and reviewed and recognized.
But did they? I thought that both of them were kind of just like self-published, you know, kind of low-key guys that kind of got discovered and people went, hey, this stuff is really good, and it kind of blew up from there.
Well, I'm not saying it's impossible. I mean, it is possible for people to get discovered as long as the right people
see
give it a shout out. And it's all a matter of knowing or being able to contact the right people to get it in front of them and being able to communicate. And I mean, you can have a great author who's not a great personal communicator, and that's going to really handicap them. So there's thousands of factors that go into whether a book is successful or not. And I just think that the flood effect of the self-publishing market is not beneficial. But that could just be my bias because I am an author myself, and I'm totally willing to recognize the fact that being an author removes my impartiality.
Sure. But at the same time, I mean, don't you have to admit that the fact that, you know, now any yahoo who can put pen to paper at least has the possibility of finding a market. Not that it's good that bad and mediocre works can find a market and potentially drown out the good works. But, you know, it's definitely a time where authors who maybe wouldn't necessarily get picked up by a publisher have more of an opportunity than they've ever had in the history of publishing to get their message and to get their, you know, to get their work out there. And isn't that a net good thing?
It is a very good thing. I'm not certain it's a net good thing, because if you can't pitch it to an editor and the editor isn't willing to go through and critique it with you, mm-hmm. I think that that shows a very large weakness. However, it is good that people have access and have the ability to get, you know, get out there. So I really think we don't have enough information. This hasn't been a thing long enough for us to know if this is a net good or net negative to the writing community, to authors in general, or to civilization in general, because this is really a big subject, because the literature that we consume as a culture affects our culture in a huge way.
Sure.
So this is really a civilization-wide question that we're dealing with right now. And I just don't think we have enough knowledge, enough data to know whether this is a good thing or a bad thing.
You know, so I'm kind of getting a little existential based on what you just said. And it's always easy to say, you know, these times that we're in or kids these days, and people have been saying that for, you know, forever. We always are the worst generation coming up and we're having the worst problems that we've ever had. But I mean, it does seem like, at least culturally, and I can't speak for, you know, outside of America, but in America, it does seem like there is a lot less emphasis on reading. And, you know, so, and when series like Harry Potter come out and they're celebrated because, oh, they're getting kids to read. I mean, what are the, do you see, a decline in the interest in literature, culturally, and is that a real thing, or is it just a perceived thing because things always seem terrible and in 10 years we'll look back and say that there was never a problem? But I mean, it are there the Mark Twains today, and the fantastic authors, are they out there and you just can't see it because you don't see it until you're retrospectively looking back, or is that an era that has passed?
Well, I'm not sure if I'm qualified to answer this question, because I've only been writing, well, I've been writing since 2008, but my books have only been on the market since 2014. And so I haven't really seen any significant change in the marketplace in that time period. However, it's my fear that that's the situation. And looking at the data that's available, you get people, it's like they herald Harry Potter as a great thing to get people into reading, but then these kids don't go out and read other books. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, I'm not going to read that because it's not Harry Potter.
Well, that's
okay,
true.
So speaking as someone who has, you know, older children than five, I don't see that. Kids, just the same as when I was in school, there are kids that are immersed. My daughter has probably read – 35 to 50 books over this summer break.
Wow.
Wow. You should reward her for that in some way.
Well, I mean, you know, we talk about books. I mean, now some of those are ones that she's reread. Like she just finished rereading the Twilight series again for the umpteen bajillionth time. But she gets that on us because there are book series that I've read 10, 15, 20 times as well. So, but, you know, she has friends that don't read, but there, I mean, there are a lot of people that still read. And I would say it's proportionally the same as when I was in school. I mean, I devoured books when I was in school, just like she does. And, you know, my older son doesn't read. My middle son is somewhere in between. You know, he reads some, doesn't read as much as she does. So, yeah, I mean,
was the case. I said it was my fear.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, no. I mean, I understand the fear, and I think it is realistic, only because there are more entertainment options now than there were 100 years ago. I mean, 100 years ago, you either read a book or you didn't have any entertainment, right? I mean, you know, for all intents and purposes, that was the cheap entertainment of time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So obviously,
Here's what happens whenever I go to conventions or book signings. You have about 30% of the people who walk by who are interested in what you got. But then a good 60 to 70% of those people who stop and take a look at it, they're like, that's really cool. I don't read. I'll wait till the movie comes out.
Which and is I'm like, terrible.
Oh, the movie's not going to come out unless enough people read it.
Yeah, and you know, even if the movie does come out, I mean, they have to make so many compromises to make a movie work. And yeah, I cannot think of a single instance, and I'm trying to think kind of on the fly, where I've seen a movie and read a book and thought the movie did it better. And I can't think of one. I'm sure there's an example out there, but I can't think of it.
A River Runs Through It. But that was just because it was basically the book.
Yeah, and I have not read the book. And
I don't think I've seen the movie. 90-page novella or short story.
That's because of the power of the imagination. You can visualize in your own mind the perfect shade of blue. You can visualize in your mind something that is truly terrifying to you specifically.
Well, yeah, and the perfect shade of blue is different for every person, right? And
exactly.
So when a book says blue, what I envision and what Jacob envisions are very different things.
Yeah.
And when he says he has a beard, you know, somebody who doesn't like beards could think this, you know, ugly, scraggly thing that, you know, has giant gaps in it and stuff like that. Whereas us, as all people with facial hair, we're going to think this thick, majestic, you know, mane on his face. And so it might come out totally different to two different people.
Yeah, absolutely. I will say that, you know, not to pick on the to go back to the Harry Potter thing, I think Daniel Radcliffe was Harry Potter. Like, to me, they could not have cast that role any better. And I did read the books first. So.
Yeah, I haven't thought about that. I suppose that's probably true, but I think I might have seen the first movie before I read the first book.
Yeah, the same with me, because I was never into her writing. I was into the other stuff. I was into more sci-fi classics and fantasy classics before she started coming out with her books.
Sure.
So
I guess I didn't realize. Does J.K. Rowling have a history prior to Harry Potter?
No.
It's coffee writing in coffee shops while on unemployment checks.
Well, I was going to say, I thought Harry Potter was kind of her, like she sat down and wrote it and $1 billion later, there she is.
Yeah.
I didn't think that she had been a writer prior to that.
She actually tried writing a novel under a different pen name because she wanted to know if she still had it, if she could still sell a popular book that was not under her already massively powerful name.
Oh, and what happened? Because I have not heard this story.
Well,
did she sell it?
It sold.
It sold, yeah, but it wasn't smashing success. But then people figured out it was her, and then it sold like hotcakes.
Of course, yeah. I mean, it's kind of there are some authors at this point that can literally just put, you know, drivel on a page and they're going to sell, you know, millions of units.
Stephen King.
he is a good author. I like him. I'm not saying that he is the great American author, but he's entertaining.
Well, believe it or not, Stephen King wrote a book on how to write.
Yeah,
that
probably
was my first introduction
in the mid 80s, right?
Yeah, and that was my first introduction to instruction on how to create a novel. Before I started writing The Exiled Empire, while I was still discussing it with my brother and going over concepts and just considering the idea of, you know, maybe I should try writing something, I went and got his book and read it. And, you know, it was very informative.
I say that about Stephen King, but actually the last two things that I've read from him, I've really enjoyed. So that wasn't really fair. Cause I actually really enjoyed The Joyland and I really enjoyed The Overlook Hotel.
Hustler is really monotonous.
Oh, really?
Oh my goodness. There's a lot of the big ones, especially in modern suspense or action or spy books. It's the same exact story. The only thing they did was swapped out the nouns.
Yeah.
Like the Danielle Steele book creation device.
Well, and then you always have the controversies that pop up. I know that there were, I think, even lawsuits filed against Dan Brown claiming that the Da Vinci Code was pretty much stolen out of whole cloth from another author. I can't think of the other author's name. That's got to be an author's probably biggest nightmare, is that, you know, there would ever even, whether it's true or not, there would ever even be the insinuation or the hint of plagiarism. Because, I mean, what do you have to trade on except your original creativity, right?
Yeah. And well, that's my fear. I mean, you get little things like it all the time. Like, I wrote my book in 2009 and I actually have recorded copies and, you know, copyrights and, you know, I actually did a very tiny self-publishing run back then just to test the waters. And then I realized, oh no, self-publishing, no, that's the kiss of death. So I quickly destroyed that. But I still have all the records. And the language that the natives speak is called Lothalan. And the and Star Wars came out recently with where their TV show, and the planet is called Lothal. So I'm like, ah, that's bordering on dangerous territory there.
Yeah. Oh, that's, yeah, I wouldn't even want to begin to deal with, especially going up against a powerhouse like LucasArts and Disney. And I mean, you're going to lose, no, even if you're in the right on something like that.
Well, that's why I don't challenge it. I mean, the planet's, you know, completely different name. The species completely different name. It's just Lothalan and it's different. So it's fine.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to raise, you know, the red flag of war over something so trivial as that. I'm just saying that every time that there's a tiny thing where somebody steps on your toes, it's like somebody rubbed a cat the wrong way with a wet hand.
Oh, sure.
And even on the tiniest things, it's like, don't step on my book.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and it's your thing. It's the creation that you created out of your own mind. And I mean, that's a very intensely personal thing. I get it. So I wanted to touch on that quickly because I know we've been talking for a while and we tend to try and keep the episodes, about an hour or so. Not that we've got a rush or anything like that, but, so you've mentioned a couple of times, you know, self-publishing is bad. Stay away from self-publishing. Can you elaborate just a little bit on why that's such a bad thing other than, you know, potentially people who maybe shouldn't have a voice, not having a voice, but putting subpar work out there. But I mean, like, what is swaying you so strongly away from the self-publishing? Because I don't know anything about that world at all. And if you would have asked me, I would have said, oh yeah, self-publishing, that's got to be great.
Because to your peers and potential audiences, it raises a giant banner that says, I don't believe in my work enough to pitch it to a actual publishing company. And I'm afraid to have it edited, and I am too prideful in my work to have a editor question my plot points, and I want to keep control. So you look like a control freak.
Mm-hmm.
You also look like somebody who either doesn't have the confidence to pitch it to a professional or was rejected by a professional.
Huh.
So if your book's good enough, there's a lot of small publishers out there who will accept your, you know, marginally decent work. So it's not hard to find a good self-publisher. And so from the perspective of an author, it's like raising the white flag. And it may not appear that way to everyone, but to people who are reviewers, it's a red flag. And to peers in the community, it's a very big red flag.
Interesting. So as a reader, it doesn't really sway me one way or the other. I have never
That's
really thought about
you're
it from
an open-minded good person.
Well, but I've also never really thought about it from the industry side before, which that makes a lot of sense.
And by industry, you mean the business, right?
The business, you know. Well, so I mean, obviously the internet is a valuable tool to, you know,
Here we are self-publishing our podcast. So now he just made me feel like an insignificant piece of shit. Thanks a lot.
No, there's a difference between audio and visual content and a literary content. Like, yeah, I have YouTube videos. I self-publish those on my own YouTube channel where I discuss various topics. I don't do a lot in it. It's not like it's a major marketing tool, but I, you know, anything that you do that's blogs, video, audio, that's all self-published, and it is very different.
Well, we really aren't, and like you said earlier, we're really not. I mean, yes, we're creating content, and yes, it's an endeavor of creation, but we are commentating on stuff mostly. We're not, you know, telling funny stories that we're making up on our own. We're talking about topical situations and things that interest us. So it is different. You're right.
There's a difference between impromptu performance and something that is supposed to be polished and crafted with careful consideration. And that's really the difference. You need to go through a professional when it's supposed to be something that you put a little C with a circle around it on.
Yeah. Oh, and our audience would never confuse us with people who polish and craft anything.
I was going to say, what you just described has nothing to do with what we've done ever. So that's okay then. I feel better.
I think that's right in line with what our audience should expect, Jeff.
Then you know what you want to deliver, it's
going to
deliver it.
You know, my grandfather always said, find something you like and do it average.
And do it well enough to get paid.
That's a lot easier said than done, which is why we both still have day jobs.
My favorite line is, find what you love and let it kill you.
You know, that's actually, you know, pretty profound, because if you find something that you truly love, I mean, you can do it forever and it's not tiring, it's not burdensome, and you know, it's a completely different thing. I've had the rare fortune to have had that in the past, you know, working for myself, and you know, it is different. It's hard to explain if you haven't ever had that, but I totally connect with that and get the point of that saying, because when it's something that you're truly passionate about, it's not an effort, or at least it's a joyful effort.
Even if I get to write full time, I guarantee you writing's the thing that's going to off me. And I hope that I'm going to die halfway through a really awesome sentence, so everybody forever in posterity is going to wonder, what was the end of that sentence?
That's kind of poetic. You couldn't really ask for more than that as an author.
Yeah, but I don't want, you know, finish the story.
A blog post, or because I'll be hopefully I lived long enough to be a crotchety old man, and it'll be some scathing review on something that's going on in the literary world.
I'm just saying, because like I really worry about Game of Thrones.
Well, he already told the TV producers how it's supposed to end, and if they know how it's going to end, then they'll be able to give it to some young buck author that can finish it for him.
Yeah.
I need that in my life.
I think Joshua has plenty of time, Jeff. I mean, he's only 30.
I know. I'm just saying. Now that you've sucked me into the story, you can't leave me hanging, man. That's not fair.
Yeah, and I want one of the prequels, because I want more of the Harvester War.
Yeah, I actually had a comic that I was writing. Well, a short story series, and then a comic that I was writing in the Harvester Wars. It was following Tom, you know, the one of James' lieutenants in the Exile Empire, how he had a huge gap in his memory.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually what happened during that time.
Oh, okay.
And so it's all tied into the main story.
So are any of these available anywhere online, or is this something that you're still working on?
That project was canceled because the artist had other obligations. Okay. And so I need a new artist who would be interested in that story in order to produce it. But I do have other comics that are in the works, like the wanderingrealms.com. is one that's about, I think, 20 pages in, graphic novel. I have one that's another about 30 pages in, and that's going to be just released only as a graphic novel in physical format, not going to be a webcomic. And I have about two others that are slowly burning.
Very cool. So if people want to, find your work, get a hold of you, like, what's the best avenue, for people? I know that your stuff's available on Amazon. Is that the best place to buy? Can they buy it directly from you? How do people become fans? And then once they're fans, how do they stay in touch and follow you and your work?
There's three things that I would prefer. The first one, obviously, is buy a copy of the novel. Amazon is great because it is a great review platform. And it ticks up the numbers, which makes Amazon promote it more and all that kind of stuff. And it's easy to find on Amazon. Just search for The Exile Empire or Joshua Done, D-O-N-E. Mm-hmm. And my Twitter is a great way to communicate with me. I almost always respond to every message on Twitter. And that's just Joshua, J-O-S-H-U-A, D-O-N-E. Just my name as my Twitter handle. And then you can search me on Facebook, and I have an author page and a Hyperion Empire page. So if you like both fantasy and sci-fi, you cannot like my author page. If you like sci-fi alone, you can like my author page and the Hyperion Empire page.
Very cool. Yeah, I've really enjoyed having you coming on and talking to us, Joshua.
Yeah,
thank you.
You know, when you get ready.
Thank you. This was fun.
When you get ready to put your other book out, get in touch with us and we'll talk about it.
All right. Will do.
Awesome.
Blood Nobles should be out within 6 months.
Awesome. Well, you have a great evening.
You as well.
All right. Bye.
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 All right. Well, that was really cool. I don't know that I have it in me to write a book, especially not an overarching story that's comprised of 6+ trilogies, plus all the other stuff he has mapped out and graphic novels and MMOs. And he is one
ambitious
guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to check back in with him here in a few years when he has kids.
Yeah. I wish him the best of luck.
That's
but no,
awesome.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, yeah. I finished the first book, like you mentioned, Jeff, and it's pretty good. I really enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to the second one. Like we were talking about, I really wish that I had right now the sort of prequel stuff, because I want to know more about this the Harvester War and the stuff that leads up to the start of this book. So, yeah, go check it out on Amazon. Give him a look. It's you're supporting a guy who's trying to become a full-time author, so you're doing a good thing by checking out the smaller guys and not just giving all your money to the Stephen Kings. So yeah, there you go. Jeff, what do you love?
Okay, so I'm going to pick something I found on Beats One Radio. There is a Beats One is part of the new Apple Music service, and I think it's actually free to anyone.
Yeah, I think you have to listen to ads if you don't pay.
As a radio station, yeah. But there are actually shows on there, and one of the shows happens to be a show that I just caught the other day called St. Vincent's Mixtape Delivery Service.
Okay.
And it is a really interesting show. I don't know if you know who St. Vincent is. I did not.
I don't.
Before this, but she is an electronic artist. So very,
so
yeah.
That kind of stuff.
Perfect. Yes. But she does this show, and basically the premise is someone writes in, kind of tells her about themselves, and she creates a mixtape for them.
Okay.
In the first episode, and if you can find it, I'm going to tell you how to find the playlists based on these mixtapes. But the first interview was with this 12-year-old girl, and it was just really like the back and forth between the two was just amazing.
Huh.
And you can actually go, if you go into Apple Music and you search for St. Vincent's Mixtape Delivery Service, you will actually find the old episodes playlist, but it's just the music that she talks about. It's not the interviewing with that person. But I have to tell you that as being someone who plays a lot of boots. She has
boots
a
and pants and boots and pants.
That's right.
Boots and
pants. She has a very good taste in music and just does an amazing job of putting together a list of songs that go so well together and are just fun to listen to. Huh. And I cannot recommend it enough. I am really enjoying her playlists. And so go check her out. It's it is really, the music is just really good. Like the first one I listened to, you know, had a lot of I don't know what I would call a 90s Cure-esque type tracks,
okay,
in it,
sure.
but that's what the girl was interested in. The second one has stuff like, you know, hardcore country in it. So she obviously has very, you know, wide berth of knowledge of, you know, somewhat obscure tracks for any genre. And mm-hmm. she does an amazing job of putting a list together that sounds really good too. Highly recommend not putting it on shuffle. When you play it in the order that she put it in, because she actually does a good job of things transitioning into the next song and making sense. And I just really, really appreciate what she's done. And it is very good.
That's cool. Do you know when her show is on Beats One if someone wanted to tune in and listen to it?
I knew you were going to ask me that, and I don't.
I'm not putting you on the spot. I was genuinely curious.
I think it's 10, and I think it's 10 on both ends. I think they play it at 10 p.m. Eastern time and 10 a.m. the next day.
Okay, cool. So it's every day.
Yes, it is every day.
Interesting. Yeah, I have not listened a lot to Beats One, but I've heard.
Oh, you know what? I'm going to take that back. It's once a week, and I want to say it's on Tuesday. Yeah. See, you're going to put me on the spot. I don't know, so I apologize again for being totally unprepared, because I was really doing it more as a what I love, and the fact that you could go actually get the playlist. But I do know that I think it's once a week.
All right. Well, you know what? We'll look online and we'll put it in the show notes for that one person out there who's inclined to actually go and look at the show notes.
There you go.
And what I was going to say is I have not listened to a lot of Beats One, but as I've listened to more people talk about it, apparently people are saying, hey, they're doing this radio thing right. They're letting the DJs have pretty much full control over their shows, and there's an eclectic mix. And so there's something to this. So I'm going to have to tune in some more to Beats One and pay a little bit more attention to it. Sounds like Apple is Trent Reznor-led Beats One is an interesting thing that people are starting to pay attention to, which is kind of cool.
Yes. So the St. Vincent's mixtape delivery service, if you want to listen to it on Beats One, it's every Tuesday night at 10 p.m. And then it's the following Wednesday morning at 10 a.m.
And is that Eastern or Pacific?
Eastern Standard Time.
All right. Cool.
And just to give you a little, you know, peek into the first one. The first one was with Piper. She was 11, so I was off on the age. But the song that the bands are Depeche Mode, Stereo Lab, New Order, Delight, Devo, Chaka Khan, Eraser, Bork, David Bowie, Pet Shop Boys, the Pointer Sisters, and the Talking Heads.
Huh, that is an odd eclectic mix. I'm going to have to check it out.
I'm telling you.
Because I like almost all of those people.
Yeah. So very there you cool. go.
I was going to do a twofer, and then I realized, if I do that, then I won't have something I love for the next time we have a podcast. So I'm only going to do a onefer. But what I love, it's a neat thing. It's cheap, which is always good. It is the Jarve Bluetooth 4.0 Smart Heart Rate Monitor. So what it is it's a chest strap heart rate monitor, and it's Bluetooth. It connects to your device over Bluetooth LE. It's cheap. I actually bought mine in 2014, and the reason I'm talking about it now is because I just found it again. I think I paid $35 for it. It's on Amazon right now for $35, but I was looking at Camel, which I think we've mentioned before, and it looks like it jumps back and forth between $35 and $27 or $28 pretty regularly. So you can pick one up, you know, on the pretty cheap. It works with iOS and Android devices, and with almost any workout app. I've been using it with Runkeeper when I've been going out on, if they're runs, they are, by golly, the slowest runs in the history of the planet. My sauntering walks as I'm trying to get a little bit more active and become healthier. And it supports a whole bunch of other apps, Ecomondo and all of the other ones, Strava, just pretty much any app you can throw at it. And it gives you a much better picture of the effort you're putting into your activity and the calorie burn and all of that when it adds heart rate. As a double bonus, and I thought this was really neat considering I bought mine, you know, like over a year and a half ago. I bought it in January of 2014. It connects to the Apple Watch. I haven't tested it extensively, but when you are in an activity on the Apple Watch, one of the things I noticed after, you know, working for hours and hours and hours in the yard last week is that it runs the battery down in the Apple Watch when it's doing the continuous heart rate tracking because it's using LEDs on the back and it's it kills the battery. So I don't know because I haven't tested extensively to see if a connected Bluetooth heart rate monitor will keep the battery from running down as much. But you can go right into the Bluetooth menu on your Apple Watch and it pairs right up and, you know, boom, your heart rate starts showing up there. It seems to be pretty accurate when the batteries are fresh. When I found it and pulled it out and put it on, it seemed to work just fine. And then all of a sudden, like the next time I used it, it was just jumping all over the place and not recording right. So I need to get a new battery in it, I think. But it uses a really standard, a CR2032 coin battery that are easy to find in just a couple of bucks. So it's like I said, it's a really cool little thing. It's the Jarve Bluetooth 4.0 Smart Heart Rate Monitor. If you are at all interested in better tracking your activity or maybe getting yourself a little bit more healthy, highly recommend you check it out. If you have an Apple Watch, it'll pair up with your Apple Watch. It might save your battery on those long workouts. That has yet to be tested. I am speculating, but it's pretty cool. So that is what I love today. It's kind of neat. I want to, as we wrap up our show, I want to make sure we take a chance to thank our patrons, our Patreons for supporting the show. So thank you, Dennis Heinley, Jamie Brown, Kai Layton, and Todd Singer. You guys are awesome. We really appreciate it. Like we said, to anybody that supports the show, we will give you a shout out and a mention. So you guys have been shouted at and mentioned, but seriously, we do appreciate it. And, you know, if there's anybody else out there that wants, you know, that gets, you know, any value out of the show whatsoever, wants to throw a buck or something like that our way to say thank you, help support the show, you can do that at our Patreon account. And that is patreon.com/KnowBetterShow. We greatly appreciate it. So you have just listened to another episode of the Know Better Than Average podcast. If you have any questions, rants, raves, comments, anything that you want to say to us, you can give us a call on our line. It has been a little while since we've had a call. Our last caller was John, and we appreciate it. So, you know, the rest of you out there, come on, pick up the phone. In the days of cell phones, it's free, and you don't even have to talk to a human being. It will go right to our voicemail. You can't get any more antisocial than that and still participate in a human conversation. It is awesome technology. But you can call us at 317-643-1212. We would love to hear from you. You can visit us on the website at www.knowbettershow.com. You can follow us on Twitter at KnowBetterShow. You can follow Jeff on Twitter at Jeff_Cheney. You can follow me on Twitter at NotTheRealJacob. You can send an email to feedback@knowbettershow.com. We read all of our listener email. We listen to all of our listener calls. If you want us to put you on the air, we will be happy to do that and make you internet famous. If you like the show, we would really appreciate it if you would tell your friends about us. And if you would subscribe, rate, and leave a review on iTunes. I know some of you out there hate iTunes. I get it. It's kind of a cumbersome, monstrous piece of software. But if you would just download it long enough to give us a review, that would be awesome. A few kind words and a handful of stars really goes a long way towards helping us out, growing the audience, and all of that fun stuff. We hope that you have had a good time, an interesting conversation that we had with Joshua. We will be back next week with another fantastic show. You have just listened to the Know Better Than Average podcast, so now you should know better than average too. Thanks for listening, and have a great week, everybody.
Thanks for listening, folks.